Hello. Thanks for joining us here on KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, and Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show. For KVNF News, my name is Eric Gould. On this edition of Local Motion, we'll talk about a project in the city of Delta that local organizers hope will beautify the downtown area and stimulate economic growth. The city of Delta received grant funds to have the old West's Home Center at the 300 block of Main Street be replaced by a pocket park. The grant's conditions required that the city turn the lot into a pocket park to remain in the city's ownership for a minimum of 5 years. When the lot is cleared, it will connect Main Street to the parking lot to the west. The goal is to create an inviting pedestrian space that can accommodate a variety of activities and amenities. KVNF News spoke with Delta City Manager David Torgler and asked him to talk about the process that allowed the city to proceed with the project.
We received the grant. It's a community development block grant that we received through the Department of Local Affairs. They had identified certain funds that would be available for us to do some remediation work, and we were able to work with them to identify probable project costs, and they made the funding available.
And part of the grant is that it requires the city to turn the lot into a pocket park in order to remain in the city's ownership for a minimum of 5 years. Tell me about that.
Well, a community development block grant has got a couple of basic requirements. It's got many requirements, but a couple of basic ones. One is that the city could not own the property prior to the project being approved, and then the city would have to acquire the property to make improvements afterwards, and then the city has to propose what it is that we will do with the property for a minimum of 5 years. The West Home Center was in need of being either removed or undergoing extensive repairs. The business was not occupying that space anymore, and the city's 2008 comprehensive plan had taken a look at the downtown and identified one benefit to the downtown would be the removal of certain structures in order to create a pass-through to the parking lots that are behind the buildings to encourage motorists to stop for downtown businesses and identify that there would be a place to park. So it kind of all gelled together.
The city got help from a group of landscape architecture students from the University of Colorado, Denver. In a long process that involved workshops, community get-togethers, and public meetings, the students were able to come up with a design for the pocket park that will meet everyone's needs. KVNF News spoke with Chris Andreessen. His title is West Slope University Technical Assistance Coordinator. He told us about his involvement with the Pocket Park project.
We are a partnership between the Department of Local Affairs and CU Denver. Underneath the Colorado Center for Community Development is a program called the University Technical Assistance Program. And what we do through the partnership with DOLA, Department of Local Affairs, is partner with local governments across the state to provide preliminary conceptual design and planning for projects that are in a grant phase or moving towards grants or other types of funding. And we provide the base information that the local government can use to, you know, garner support for the project as well as have a framework for what the design or the idea might be.
Graduate students in the Landscape Architecture Program held the workshop on January 15th. Andreessen said it offered a hands-on approach for them to learn the tools of the trade.
And so the students are graduate students from the College of Architecture and Planning, in particular on this project, and are helping to put together the goals and objectives of the park design based on the community input that we received at the meeting we had here a couple weeks ago, and we'll translate that into design concepts to correlate and coordinate back to the city. And then that'll turn into a final presentation at some point, which will allow the city to use that graphic conceptual design and plan, if you will, for the CDBG grant that they are using for the demolition and preparation of this particular site.
The Pocket Park is an idea stemming back to 2008, when the city examined its comprehensive plan and determined buildings in the city that could use refurbishment and renovation. It represents numerous man hours by city staff and required different grants at various stages of funding. Torgler said it was the culmination of work by a lot of people, including the many CU Denver students involved.
It is a vision that the community had starting in 2008, and we're now able to accomplish that part of it. Oh, the students from CU Denver, it's through a program set up through DOLA, and it allows for students working on their advanced degrees in architecture to work on projects in communities that benefit the community and benefit the student through that interaction. So we invited the CU Denver program to participate in this project with us by helping us design what will be the look and feel of the Pocket Park once it's completed, what amenities should go in there, how people might appreciate being able to use it, and get feedback and input from the public, which they would then take back to their classroom and discuss it and design improvements for presentation to this community.
That was Delta City Manager David Torgler, and you are listening to Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show here at KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. On this edition of the show, we're talking about a new park that is being built in downtown Delta. The students led a design workshop January 15th to gather a sense of the community's vision for the Pocket Park. Workshop participants walked through a series of storyboards illustrating amenities that could be included in the Pocket Park, including a performance area or stage, covered shelter, sculptures, art, gateway, public restrooms, playscapes, seating areas, planters, lighting, information kiosks, and bike racks. Multiple concepts were offered for each amenity. Participants expressed their preferences by placing green dots on the designs that they liked and red dots on the concepts they didn't. The same exercise was used to gauge public opinion on uses and activities, including holiday festivals, boutique markets, food trucks, small concerts, movies, storytelling, group exercise, interactive art, historical interpretation, entertainment, group picnics, and interactive games. Workshop groups were provided with tracing paper and a site plan to sketch out conceptual designs featuring their preferred amenities and activities. The exercise concluded with the presentation of those conceptual designs to the gathered workshop at large.
Yeah, we held a workshop, and so we do this often, and this format lends itself for a lot of involvement from various different folks who may or may not be graphically inclined per se, but want to still participate. And so the students led a kind of design charrette that, based off of the previous information and kind of outlining the framework of the park, the Pocket Park, and the kinds of things that could go into it or how it could be designed, use that opportunity with the breakout groups to sketch out and identify ideas that the community had for the park, which, you know, was centered around things like seating areas and the aesthetics, the flow, the pedestrian patterns, the activities that might happen there, and framing it around creating a downtown sort of living room environment for the community.
And then in terms of the designing that the students do they make digital images? Do they make models? How do they do that job?
Yeah, so we operate more in the digital realm and produce drawings and sections and perspectives and renders that portray what that final design conceptual design could look like, so that anybody looking at it has an idea that, you know, there's a bench or there's a stage or a picnic area, and has a good understanding of what that is based on the graphics that are generated.
You are listening to Local Motion here on KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. We've been talking about the new pocket park that's being constructed in downtown Delta. Ideas for its design were discussed at a workshop that involved students from CU Denver and members of the Delta public. One of the bright spots about the workshop was the participation of local Delta residents. Andreessen said that their input was valuable, and one of the purposes of the project is to get as much local input as possible.
It was really great turnout, actually. As you can imagine, sometimes various different things have different levels of turnout, but we had over 30 people from our count that came out to participate, and we had really great input, really great participation, and wonderful ideas that were generated from that.
The graduate students will work with those conceptual designs to create a multifunctional space they believe will meet the needs and desires of the community. Andreessen said that the students are really only at the beginning of the learning process.
So right now we are dissecting all the information that we've gathered and are starting our process of generating concepts, which we will coordinate back to the steering committee. And then that will translate through a series of revisions and modifications based on the grant that they have and what can fit in, you know, how things might work with that. And we'll refine it down to the point that it represents kind of the framework of what we heard at the meeting. And then that'll be opened up at a date to be determined yet for a public presentation of the final design for comment.
For City Manager David Torgler, the work is ongoing. Currently, the Old West building is being taken down safely. The timetable is coming together for a summer opening of the Pocket Park.
Yes, there's, you know, it's an older structure, so there's some things that, you know, you don't always anticipate, and some you do anticipate. There is asbestos remediation that will have to go on as the building and some of its improvements were constructed when asbestos was a common construction material. There are the adjoining walls, it's in the downtown, so the buildings butt up against each other, and the West Home Center must have been the first structure built before its neighbors to the north and south, because those neighbors, all they did was connect building framing. They didn't construct an outside wall to their buildings. They just constructed the framing and attached it to the West Center home. So as part of this demolition, we're going to have to figure out how to take down those walls, the front and the back of the building, and leave the walls that abut the north and the south. And then we've got to figure out, okay, how do we now buttress those walls so that they remain standing, because it's part of the retaining of the businesses and buildings to the north and south.
When on the time frame are we looking that the park might actually be completed?
You know, we're looking at doing construction demolition this winter and then moving into the construction phase this spring. So I think it will be late spring by the time we get it done. But, you know, if God is willing and all the plans come together, we should have it open, you know, for enjoyment by the public, by June.
According to the Delta County Independent, the City County Youth Council has been tasked with coming up with a name for the Pocket Park. Its recommendation will be brought to the City Council for final approval. And stay tuned to KVNF for more coverage of the new Pocket Park in Delta as it approaches its completion and opening date this summer. Thanks for listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, and Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show. We've just heard about the planned Pocket Park that is being built in downtown Delta, with a projected opening date sometime in June. Now here on Local Motion, we'll switch gears and update some stories about water that we've covered recently on the KVNF regional newscast. As we've talked about, the end of January was a deadline for the state of Arizona to come to a legislative agreement about drought mitigation on the Colorado River. This is important because the six other states in the Colorado River Basin have reached their agreements, and water levels are reaching a point where shortages are expected this year. KUNC's Luke Runyon filed this story to set the stage.
Arizona lawmakers have started taking up legislation tied to a broader agreement among the seven states that rely on the river for drinking and irrigation water. The federal government has told the states to come up with a plan to curb water use in the basin and to avoid seeing its biggest reservoir, Lake Mead, outside Las Vegas, crash. Arizona is the only state that requires its legislature to sign off. Home builders, farmers, cities, and tribes have gathered at the State House this year to hammer out the deal's details. If Arizona fails to meet the deadline, a Bureau of Reclamation spokesperson says the agency will get involved to help manage the overtaxed water source. I'm Luke Runyon.
And to hear what happened in Arizona, let's listen to H2O Radio's This Week in Water.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The deadline was January 31st for the seven states of the Colorado River Basin to agree on drought plans or face the prospect of the federal government stepping in to impose mandatory cutbacks. Now, the feds say two states still have not completed their plans, but they have an extra month to comply.
The aim of the contingency plans is to conserve water as too much has been taken out of the river. The Associated Press reports that the Bureau of Reclamation's Commissioner Brenda Berman has said that without action, Lake Mead could fall to a level referred to as a dead pool, with Arizona, Nevada, and California not getting any Colorado River water.
Five states met the deadline, but on Friday, the commissioner gave California and Arizona until March 4th to finalize their plans. In the meantime, the commissioner has started the process to take over management of the river, which she could halt if the two states get them done.
The problem in Arizona is that 15 different water users need to sign agreements to the plan, which the governor's office has called a formality.
In California, the Imperial Irrigation District, the single largest user on the river, is holding out until it gets a commitment from the federal government to help restore the Salton Sea, a large, dwindling lake which is badly polluted.
On a conference call, Commissioner Berman said that neither state had completed all the necessary work, and close isn't done.
The tap water of millions of Americans is contaminated with two chemicals that were used in making products like Teflon-coated cookware and in firefighting foams. Last week, Politico obtained information that the chemicals, known as PFAS and PFOA, will remain unregulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act.
In reaction to the news, The Hill reports that a bipartisan group of 20 senators have called upon the EPA to regulate the compounds, saying that without drinking water standards, it's doubtful that states and communities can address the challenges these chemicals pose.
The acting head of the EPA, Andrew Wheeler, has been in confirmation hearings to become the permanent administrator, but the agency's inaction on the contaminants could jeopardize Senate approval. A Senate committee vote on his appointment could be coming this week.
PFAS and PFOA have been linked to cancers, hypertension, and other ailments. Wheeler earlier testified to the Senate that he could not commit to a set of drinking water limits for the chemicals.
The National Weather Service in Iowa last week warned people not to go outside if possible, and if they did, not to breathe deeply and to keep talking to a minimum as brutally cold air swept from the Arctic into the Midwest.
The low temperatures were caused by a breakdown of the polar vortex, which is a giant whirlpool of frigid air high in the atmosphere. The walls of the whirlpool can sometimes split apart, sending cold air from the Arctic into the U.S. and Europe.
Two researchers told the New York Times that they suspect more frequent breakdowns can be tied to climate change. The Arctic is warming about twice as fast as the rest of the world on average, which has led to historically low levels of sea ice. As ice is lost, the sea absorbs more heat from the sun, forming a persistent hotspot.
Research suggests that the hotspot, along with changes in the jet stream caused by climate change, are breaking apart the vortex, sending the frigid air south. But the BBC reports that there's debate about whether these polar vortex breakdowns are occurring more frequently. And finally, when the government was shut down for 35 days, many national parks took it on the chin as visitors left piles of trash and human waste, sprayed graffiti, used unauthorized trails, not to mention the loss of significant revenue from visitor fees and concessions.
But in Northern California, about 30 miles north of San Francisco, there was a small act of vandalism, but not by humans. With no government workers to shoo them away, around 100 elephant seals made a temporary home on a beach at Point Reyes National Seashore, knocking down fences and snuggling under picnic tables as they settled in. It's breeding season, and mother seals with their newborn pups took to the beach to fatten up before heading back out to sea.
And although the government is now open and rangers have returned to work, the seals, well, they're not budging. Typically, the Guardian reports, during breeding season, park staff use harmless hazing techniques, which involve shaking big blue tarps to move the animals farther down the beach to separate them from people. Elephant seals may look cute and harmless, but they can move fast and sometimes get aggressive if visitors or their pets get too close.
The mammals were nearly hunted to extinction in California, but bounced back in the early 1970s thanks to protected beaches like in Point Reyes. Spokesman John Deloso told CNN there were about 40 pups born in January. They'll be likely nursing with their moms for the next couple of months.
While the shutdown is over, the beach will remain closed to visitors, with rangers on hand to provide viewing opportunities and education about these remarkable creatures from a safe distance. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Waterworks Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
That was This Week in Water from H2O Radio. And finally, here on Local Motion, a recent study found that a changing climate could cut the length of ski season in half in some parts of the U.S. by the year 2050. And more by the end of the century. This could have significant impacts on Colorado's ski industry, which generates almost $5 billion annually and creates more than 46,000 jobs. KDNK's Amy Haddon Marsh takes a look at two resorts on Colorado's West Slope to find out what they're doing to protect the snow and the bottom line.
Sunlight Mountain Resort near Glenwood Springs opened early this year on November 23rd. 2017 was a different story. Opening day was December 21st, the latest start of ski season at Sunlight since 1985. 2017 was also the third driest year on record in Colorado, and snowpack statewide was the lowest in three decades. At Sunlight, natural snowfall was down by half that year, and it was too warm to make much snow. Visits were down 25%. Sunlight is a small resort with 680 acres of skiable terrain and $1 million annual budget. It caters mostly to locals, with an average of 80,000 to 100,000 skier visits per year. Troy Hawks, Sunlight's marketing director, says 2017 was interesting, but not the first time the state has had a dry winter.
When we talked to the old timers of this valley, they said the last time they saw a snow year like last year was in 78-79 season, as I understand it.
He added that the year before, which would have been the 2016-2017 season, was a record year for Sunlight. But Colorado winters have become variable enough for Sunlight to take precautionary measures, such as purchasing new, more efficient snowmaking guns and building two new snowmaking ponds. Cameron Wobus, a senior scientist at Linker Technologies, a water and environmental resources consultant group in Boulder, says that's one thing ski resorts need to be doing, adapting to climate change.
What ski resorts can do is they can make their snowmaking more efficient. One adaptation that is being implemented in various places around the world is downloading. So basically having a gondola that can get people to the middle of the mountain where there might be more snow, and then you just ski the top half of the mountain.
Wobus worked on a 2017 study about projected climate change impacts on skiing and snowmobiling in the U.S. He said the goal of the study was to understand the difference between what happens if we start mitigating carbon emissions and what happens if we don't.
The higher resorts, Arapahoe Basin is the one that sticks out because it's the highest resort in the state of Colorado, might have reductions, you know, 10 to 20% change in season length under the worst scenario. Some of the lower resorts have much more significant changes in season length.
But ski resorts statewide are already experiencing fewer visitors, particularly in the early part of ski season. The 23 resorts that are members of the trade group Colorado Ski Country USA reported an average of 8% fewer skier visits in December 2016 than the previous season. December 2017 visits were 13% down from that. Vail Resorts reported a 13% decline in skier visits for December 2016 and an additional 11% decline in 2017. Skiing as a sport has a small carbon footprint, but Wobus says the industry could suffer significant impacts from shorter winters and needs to take more of a stand against climate change.
What some ski resorts have been doing, particularly Aspen, I'll point out, are using their customer base and their position in the industry to really take a leadership role in getting people to think about climate change.
This isn't really about your carbon footprint or mine. We now know that we have a global problem, and we have to respond to it at global scale.
Auden Schendler runs the sustainability program for Aspen Skiing Company and sits on the Basalt Town Council.
So you could argue the big, powerful organizations who have access to wealth and influence are the exact organizations that ought to be pushing hard on climate. And that's what we're doing.
With 5,000 acres of skiable terrain, 1.4 million annual skier visits, and 4,000 employees, Aspen Ski Co., as it's known locally, is considerably larger than Sunlight Mountain Resort. Schendler said that in the face of a changing climate, Aspen Ski Co. has improved infrastructure and expanded geographically by offering the Icon Ski Pass, which includes other resorts.
But to me, that's just business. The issue is, how do we reduce the impact of this problem for everybody so that maybe you retain some level of skiing down the line, but more importantly, that you do what you have the power to do as a ski resort, which is maybe influence a social movement and reduce the damage.
Schendler adds that Aspen Ski Co. has been involved with state environmental and energy policy issues for over a decade. Back at Sunlight, Troy Hawks says their climate policy focuses on conservation, education, and maintaining a small footprint.
We are not overbuilt. We are not a mega resort. We've got three small chairlifts. We've got a small bed and breakfast that has about 19 rooms, and that really sums up the size of our resort.
Aspen Ski Co.'s resources allow the company to take bigger steps than smaller ski areas, but Schendler says it's too late to compare the actions of larger resorts to those of small resorts.
We have 10 years to essentially rewire the global economy so that it's carbon free. So the question of the day should not be, hey, you're big, that one's small, their carbon footprint's less. The question is, what's the biggest leverage you have access to, and are you using it to drive change?
Despite his study's warning, ski industry consultant Cameron Wobus says skiing is not going away.
Depending on where you are, ski resorts might be starting to see really short ski seasons if we don't do anything to mitigate carbon emissions. But skiing is not over. There will always be places where you can get high enough to find snow. And fortunately for those of us in Colorado, many of those places are in our state.
For Connecting the Drops, I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.
Connecting the Drops is a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio Stations and Water Education Colorado. Find out more at watereducationcolorado.org. Support is provided by CoBank, which provides financing solutions for rural water systems. Find out more at cobank.com.
You have been listening to Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show, here on KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for listening.